You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
The battle itself, the time you guys are on there for about a month or so, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. I know you know exactly how long you were on there, but I don't think you guys were there exactly the same time, right?
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, you went in on the same day, but did you both leave exactly the same day?
I would imagine
no, I don't
so.
Think
do you remember when you left, Ray?
Maybe 2 or 3 days after everything was kind of wrapped up there, if that's the term to use. Now, the island was declared secure on the 15th of March or something like that, and that meant that everything was under control. We had complete control of the island. That was a bunch of baloney.
When did you leave? The day? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I left the day that they said, there's the boat, go and get on it. I don't know. I had it written down somewhere. I was on the island 35 days. The battle was 35 days, and I probably left 2 or 3 days later.
How about you, Howard?
The day that they declared the island secure, which was March the 15th, on that particular day, to soothe the reading public at home, they published no more casualties. They couldn't take any off because then the news man would say, aha, I saw one go off. I got wounded that particular day, and for 10 days I laid around there in a foxhole with people stopping by to make sure that my poncho was covered all right and whatnot. And when the time came, we went down, got in file, and walked down to the beach, and Navy Chief Corman down there pulled me out of line and put me on a hospital ship. As near as what my compadres tell me, that was the 25th or 26th of March. Now, during that particular time, if you were to read, I guess, the newspapers, nobody fired a shot, nobody got dead or hurt or went without food or sleep or anything else, which was one of the big gloss-over factors that we had to put up with.
The stuff they're doing today, they were doing back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just happened. That was in the news recently, that the commanders in Afghanistan were not going to release detailed information about casualties. And I guess, again, it has to do with, as you mentioned in the book, the public's patience was wearing thin. And so I guess they had to manipulate the media, which, again, they do it all the time. They're doing it right now as we speak. I want to talk about the actual battle that you both went through. And I want to look at page 23. Where you say, Howard, that everything I saw for the next few hours is still plainly visible if I close my eyes, as clear to me after 60 years, of course you wrote this in 89-90, as it was at the instant it happened. Time will never dull these scenes, nor will I ever be able to erase them from my mind's eye. Is that still the way it is now?
I'm afraid so, yeah. Last night was trying to take some sleeping pills and whatnot to get settled down so I could talk to you today, because it was all there.
So it all comes back almost like it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
How about you, Ray?
I don't have some of the problems that some people have of real bad emotions about all of this, but I will say that on Iwo Jima Day, it was actually Sunday, and I was in church, and I turned around, and I mentioned to one of my friends of mine at church there, Curtis Cole, I said, this is Iwo Jima Day. 67 years ago today, I landed on Iwo Jima, and I can see that just as plain in front of me as I'm looking at you. I remember that beach and so many details of that, but some of it is very, very clear. And there are other very emotional parts of it to me that were very clear.
One of the things both of you guys mentioned was the smell during battle.
Oh, yeah.
Ray, what about that?
Well, I think there were three smells that I could identify. One was the smell of death. That was always there and sometimes closer because we had piles of dead bodies and they hadn't gotten to get rid of them yet or bury them. And another one was the smell of gunpowder or explosives. I think that was always there. And then there was usually the smell of sulfur because we're sitting on top of some bubbling sulfur down below. They mined sulfur there at one time and maybe they're mining it again. But the smells were there.
Howard, how about you?
After 1 or 2 days, I guess, I didn't smell it anymore. It was there, that's all. And as far as what you breathe every breath, one was no different from the last, but it was there. It got to the point where they had a stand down on the 7th day, and they had lost so many men by that time that they were trying to regroup their forces. And in doing that, why, they basically shut the battle down for a day and moved you from this unit here over to this unit. And they finally, we've got one squad together over there, and we got a squad together over here. And this is where they went through, and they cleaned out everybody and everything. You know, I can probably remember 5% of it or 10% of it. I don't know whether it was because it was all so much the same or because it was the mind shutting down, trying to cut all of this off from what you're seeing to save your sanity, I guess, which is what I've always attributed it to.
Right. Ray, on page 272, you say that it was never quiet. There was always gunfire several places on the island at any time. If we had known absolute quiet, it would be too spooky, and we would really get scared. And then, Howard, you wrote about when there was a break, said guys would just shoot their weapons for no reason or throw grenades. Ray, what was the sound like?
Well, it wasn't necessarily all right nearby, but the island was, what, 9,000 acres or something like that. And you could hear things that were going on 3 or 4 miles away, machine gun fire and some larger explosions and stuff like that. But I don't think that there was any time that any more than 30 seconds or a minute went by without hearing some firing. And sometimes there was a lot going on, and there would be firefights at different places. But there was always something happening.
Right. The shells falling constantly. On page 42, you say that the continual shelling was just often enough and random enough to jar you awake. So you guys really didn't get much sleep on there, Howard?
No, you didn't get any sleep. Eventually, we got to the point where you were just so tired that as long as they weren't within some particular distance around where you were, you could go ahead and go to sleep as long as you knew that you had somebody that was in that hole that was awake.
Oh, yeah.
Ray, how about your experience with this shelling?
I'd hear it. There was a time in the first 4, 5, 6 days that we were there. Most of us that were on the island were in a rather small area. We hadn't really started to move out to the north yet. So there was a lot of artillery coming in, our mortars coming into where we were, because we had thousands of men in a pretty small area. And so they had a pretty easy target, and they'd be lobbing stuff into that area. And some of it was very close. Three of us had dug a hole. Actually, in some places, it was easy to dig foxhole. Foxes don't make the holes. We dig holes in the ground so that we can be beneath the level of the ground, at least when we're resting or sleeping. Not too far from this foxhole that we dug, maybe 35, 40 feet from there, was a Jeep and a Jeep driver. And it started a light rain that night, and the Jeep driver, to keep from getting wet, decided to sleep underneath his Jeep. A little bit later on, we could hear a shell coming in, and it was a direct hit on the Jeep. There was nothing left there but smoke.
Right.
We were getting a lot of shelling. They had a bunch of us in a small area, and so we made a pretty good target. Maybe Howard has the same experience.
Page 46, Howard, where you say the HE shells, which are high explosive shells, rained shrapnel on us at speeds greater than gravity. Mingled with
right.
The shrapnel were myriads of small pieces of phosphorus, which burns at a temperature so high that it will eat through clothing, skin, flesh, and even bone. Burning phosphorus can't be extinguished with water. It must be dug out or allowed to burn itself out. If there were two of you in a foxhole, it was your job to use the point of your combat knife to dig out any piece of phosphorus that fell on your partner before it could burn too deeply into him, and he had to do the same for you. Neither of you could leave your foxhole to avoid a falling piece of phosphorus. The regular shelling was too heavy for that. It was pure hell. It's kind of like something out of a nightmare or something out of like Dante's Inferno.
It wasn't a picnic.
No. Were you hit by any of that phosphorus, Howard?
No, I wasn't hit by phosphorus. I was hit during that particular time that they were doing that. Some guy up there had a pattern worked out, and he was firing 49 shells, 7 up and 7 back and down, and he worked on that all night long. And once the phosphorus started in the morning, he dropped a mortar shell a foot off of my foot, jammed my knee up into my chest. The shelling, it came in from multiple directions. And there was not a damn thing you could do about it, except just lay there and wait, see if it was your turn or not.
Right. And as you said on page 48, the old infantryman's axiom says, God has smiled on those who die instantly. So you guys were probably thinking about that all the time. That, and of course you said in there, and this was page 87, please God, make it just a wound when it comes.
Yeah, you're looking for what they called a stateside wound.
I think you called it $1 million.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Ray, were you thinking the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I got nicked a couple times, but nothing official, because you're not officially wounded unless you go to the battalion aid station and they could check in there. And I didn't go to the battalion aid station. I had work to do straight ahead of me.
There were no doctors up where we were.
Right.
We only had corpsmen. If you got wounded, the corpsman had to tag you and you were taken back to the aid station. And there, a doctor could assess what was wrong with you, and you officially became a casualty. Otherwise, even if the corpsman tagged you and couldn't get you out of where you were up there, you were not a casualty. You did not get your Purple Heart. So you look around up there in the later stages of this, and I think every infantryman up there was bandaged. Either one had been able to get back to the aid station or were like most of the others. If there's four or five of us that are fighting together and we're protecting each other's back and you get a cut, slash, something or other, as long as it didn't hurt anything, you bandaged it up there and you stayed there. You owed that to the people you were with to stay with them rather than leave them and go back to the aid station.
Right. And that's something both of you talked about, was the esprit de corps of the Marines, the bond that you had, that literally you were one fighting unit. You knew that your buddy was going to back you and you were going to back him. And something amazing about the Marines.
You were with your brothers. You were all brothers.
Right.
And the thing of it is, when you say we're all brothers, the guy that I am next to right now is not from the unit I came up with this morning or a couple hours earlier. He's the man that's next to me. He's my buddy. He was a Marine. That was all I needed to know.
Right.
And you try and take care of them, and they try and take care of you.
And one of the sad things, page 27, you're talking about all of the shells landing and all the people being hit. And you were saying that Jap artillery kept pounding the beach and people were being wounded faster than the corpsmen could treat them. Even after they had been treated and were awaiting evacuation, many were wounded again, often fatally this time, by shrapnel from new incoming shells. I thought about that and I thought how the guy got wounded, he's all bandaged up, he's ready to go, and he didn't even get a chance to go. He was killed right there.
Well,
they had targets and they knew where the beach was.
Yeah. That beach, you could stand up there, say, in the area where they raised the flag, and you could look up and down that beach just like you were sort of like a lifeguard station at the beach at Santa Monica or something like that. You could see everything from up there. And so when they see these corpsmen bring these wounded in and whatnot, put two of them together so that they're ready to put on the next landing craft that comes in or whatnot, hey, those people up there could see it, and they'd drop shell on it. It was just like, I don't know, swatting flies, I guess.
Shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, that'd be better.
And well, that's why taking Suribachi was so important, because they had the high ground. They could see everything on the island, and they could direct fire from there. They see something going on, a crowd of Marines or something, and they could direct fire onto them or the beach. You could see the whole thing.
Right. There, but for the grace of God, go I, right? I mean, you're here for whatever reason or reasons, but maybe you wouldn't have been here if, Howard, you weren't around the back end of that tank, you're around the side of the tank and you were buffeted from the shell, or Ray, if you were just up a little higher and that bullet didn't whiz through the fold in your pants, or the bullet wasn't stopped by your rolled blanket, Howard. I mean, you guys maybe shouldn't be here, but you say here on page 95, you learn fast by watching and copying the actions of the quick, or you didn't survive. Some of the replacements were not on the line long enough for their names to be known to anybody in the units they were assigned to before they died. You learned fast by watching and copying the actions of the quick, or you didn't survive.
That's well written.
Yeah, Howard, you made it a mental note to pay attention to the people who you felt were the quick ones and who knew how to survive. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know whether it was done consciously or not, but it certainly was there. It's what got you through it, is by paying attention to what was going on around you.
Right.
You couldn't go off blindly by yourself. You wouldn't last 30 seconds.
Right. How about you, Ray?
Oh, same thing. One of the things I thought of many times after I got out of it, I can walk out in my backyard here and just gaze around the neighborhood and enjoy watching the squirrels and seeing what's going on next door and all that sort of stuff. You couldn't do that. You're standing out there, or you take a little stroll, you're dead. Or you just stand out there, just take a few breaths and try to relax a little bit, you're gone. You cannot do that. You got to keep moving or keep hidden, and because they're there waiting for you, and
right.
You can't see them. Kind of tough.
They, you're talking about, of course, are the Japanese. You guys had, in the book, referred to them as Japs and Nips. And, of course, you just said that earlier, both you guys. Of course, nowadays, I guess it's politically correct to not to use those type of terms in public, I guess. Do either of you have any ill feelings towards the Japanese, Ray?
Not now. At that time, of course, you saw them, you shot them, they see you, they shoot you, and that's about as simple as it is, really. When we got to Japan in occupation, I was really very surprised. At first, they were very frightened when we marched into Sasebo. As a matter of fact, Sasebo is a city of about 250,000, and there were hardly any people in town. They knew that we were coming in occupation, and they all spread out into the countryside because they were told that in order to be a United States Marine, you had to prove that you killed both your mother and your father. And so they were expecting to be shot, raped, and everything else. I understand that. And it really wasn't more than a few days or a couple of weeks, and we started to be able to mingle a little bit with the Japanese citizenry, and we were welcome, almost as if we were friends or something like that. I didn't feel any antipathy. A lot of them wanted to talk with us. This was a surprise to me, because some countries being occupied, there's a great deal of emotion between us and them. And you couldn't walk down a street, but you'd be dragged into an alley and killed. I spoke with a Japanese man after we were there. We were in Moji City, and we were in some barracks. Actually, it had been offices, I guess, and there was a fence around it, and there was a large plank missing from the fence, and we were interested in seeing what was going on and what people were there, and we started talking with some Japanese kids through this hole in the fence, and I got invited over to their home, which wasn't too far away, and I went over there, and I was treated very nicely. They gave me some food and lots of smiles, and I talked with their father. He had been a manager, and maybe still was, a manager of a power plant or something. And we drank either plum wine or sake and toasted to peace between our two countries. I was very surprised at how the Japanese army and the Japanese people weren't quite the same folks. I guess that's the easiest way to put that.
Right.
I'll agree with him on that the Japanese military and the Japanese people were two different worlds. The first day that we landed in Sasebo, after I got through food around in the morning, I came back down and was sent down to the dock. And there was nice concrete quays and a lot of equipment down there. There had been a lot of damage by bombing and whatnot. But anyway, I was given a platoon of Japanese naval officers from the Navy school a couple miles down the road. And I worked with them for about 2 days, and it was really amazing to be able to pick one out, and he's my boss, and I try to explain to him what we want done, and he explains to the other 89 of them what they want done. They worked for me for 2-3 days anyway. I managed to give them breaks or got them fed meals. The Navy came down and set the tables and saw horses up, and we went through and fed them meals when the time they, of course, weren't eating what we were doing, but the Navy tried, and they got tea and coffee and muffins and all kinds of stuff like that. And they were just no different than we were. That was all, just right. Different uniform.
Right. But the Japanese military that were on Iwo Jima, they did some things that never in a million years could you imagine that people would do, right?
That's right. That is correct. How can you go through what that is with people that are willing to deface, is a good word for it, a Marine that has been wounded or captured or something, to these people that were willing to try their best to please you?
Did either of you ever come across any Marines who had been, they mutilated them too, didn't they? Tortured and mutilated them, right?
That's what I heard, but I don't think I saw any or talked with any that had this done. I know it was going on, and as a matter of fact, just to kind of help keep the record straight, I had known that sometime in the war, maybe our Marines or soldiers had sometimes mutilated a Japanese and sent him back howling to his own lines, and this is sort of in retaliation. We weren't always perfectly saintly. I'm not trying to excuse anybody. I'm just trying to say that emotions were running high.
Yeah, emotions were running high is the better word for it.
Mm-hmm. And on page 135, you say that a despicable but more effective Jap trick was to act like a wounded Marine pleading for help in the dark.
They would call out in the night.
To try to lure one of you guys out there.
Yes, yes.
And it happened a couple times before you wised up to it, right?
Many times. The Japanese could speak better English than a lot of the Southerners we had in our troops. So,
I remember reading that from, I think you said from Alabama or Georgia or something like that. Yeah,
yeah,
I remember that.
I spoke of myself as a spare part, and that's what I was. I was available for anything that they needed done that I could do. But even though I was an armorer category or specialist, I think 90% of the time in camp, I was out there practicing with a line company. happening, and with a rifle platoon. And on Iwo Jima, I had a few special assignments, but I'd say that probably with the exception of a couple of days or a few hours, I was a rifleman with one outfit or another, and if some of these outfits got all shot up, I was a replacement. But I knew more than a lot of the replacements that came in knew, because I'd had the training. But I was a rifleman, and I enjoyed being a rifleman and be part of a team. I'd be part of different teams at different times, but it was all the same thing. They're your brothers. They're trying to keep you alive, and you're trying to keep them alive.
Exactly. Talking about weapons, of course, you were the armorer. You preferred the Springfield 03 over the M1 Garand?
Yes, yes. Well, the Garand, if you could clean that weapon every day, it would work well. But you start to get a little bit of sand and it gets on the ground and get some dirt in there, the gas operating automatic mechanism doesn't work a lot of times. And I'd gotten information from higher up having to do with these weapons, and we had some problems with them. If they were clean, they would work just fine, and they would fire semi-automatically, but they would jam pretty easily. And when I went through boot camp, I went through with the Springfield 03. I liked that. It's a little bit slower, but if you really knew how to do it, you could get bullets out of that thing awful fast. That's another story. It's more accurate. And I was firing at this cave up on Suribachi, and that was probably, 350 yards away or something like that. But I had a lot more faith in the Springfield and the sights on it. I had a lot more faith in the Springfield than the Garand.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Howard?
Once we went into the demolition business, we were able to outfit ourselves any way that we wanted, and you could get it. And the thing that we ended up that we really preferred was the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle. Slow firing, but accurate. It outdid the 03 in accuracy. It was heavy to carry and whatnot, but boy, if you have one there with you, they were a nice piece of equipment to have with you.
Mm-hmm. One thing you haven't brought up. One of the first things that people ask me if we get to talking about something like this is, were you afraid? And anybody that says he wasn't afraid was drunk. I remember how I felt, and I think each man handles this in his own way. Some of them can't handle that, and they go kind of nuts. But when people talk to me about this, here's what I tell them. I say, remember when you were in high school? And this could apply to girls as well as boys. And you say, Dad, I want to go to the basketball game tonight. And he said, okay, be home at 11:30. I said, all right, I'll be home at 11:30. And 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm walking up to the front of my house, kind of hoping that Dad's asleep somewhere. And the living room is ablaze with lights. And I walk in, and there's my dad sitting there waiting for me. And you get this feeling. He doesn't even have to say anything. You get this feeling of fear. You don't even know what the hell you're afraid of. Because he's not standing there with a gun or with an axe or something like that. But you know that you've done something wrong, and there's a lot of fear there. Now, the nice thing about this with your dad is you may have a talk that evening and may get given a little bit of a punishment, but next day that's gone. We didn't have a next day like that. Every day was the same. I could feel fear like a buzz in my body all the time, and it never went away. Different men and women probably handle this in different ways, but it was there. I tried to think of it as a motivator. Maybe help me, you better run faster or do this or that. Many things that we did there that you never do back home, life isn't the same.
I'm glad you brought that up. Howard, how about you? Were you afraid all the time?
I think anybody that wasn't was something mentally wrong with them. I can't remember the feeling, but on the second morning there when they were shelling us with the phosphorus and whatnot, that particular mortar shell that burst on top of my foot there, up till that point, I guess I hadn't really thought about it, and I know it's impossible, but I could hear that particular shell coming, and I know that the pin was coming out up there, and I could hear this thing falling. It went off and whatnot, and you come out from underneath the sand and the crop that it threw up. All of a sudden, I knew that there's somebody up there watching me. Well, if I help them, they'll help me. So I guess we're back to there's no atheists in foxholes.
I read that. I can't remember what page it was on, but you knew that you were going to make it through. You never thought once that you were going to die.
No.
I think maybe I found out a lot more about how fear felt for me about 5 days after I got off the island. My body just buzzed all the time. And that was fear. we got on a ship and we were going back to Hawaii, and we weren't anywhere near as crowded as we were when we came over, where they had but 5 layers of bunks down in the hold. We had plenty of room on this ship, and we were out on the deck of this Navy ship. And maybe 3 or 4 days after we were off the island, and everybody is just starting to relax a little bit and enjoy the sunshine, and there were no formations and nothing we had to do, and I guess I got a hold of a couple of cigars somewhere, and I'm enjoying the cigar and the sunshine and the sea, and all of a sudden, the loudest damn noise I have ever heard. We were on the stern of the ship. And they had a 5-inch gun there on the stern of the ship, and they were going to have some gun practice, and they hadn't announced this. And we're all just starting to get back to normal, and wham, there were guys trying to dig in the steel deck, some of them about ready to jump overboard, and some of them looking to get away anywhere as fast as they could, and everybody was all scared again. And it kind of let us know how things were different, or at least starting to get different again. That was quite an experience.
I did highlight that. I was going to ask you to talk about that, so I'm glad you did. Howard, did you want to say something before I moved on to the next topic?
Yeah, like I told you, I was on a hospital ship 5 days off the island or something like that. And about 9 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, these guns started going pop, 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 pop. And there was not a Marine on the deck. They were all trying to get in under something. It didn't make any difference. We were trying to get away from this firing. And it no sooner had really started than the captain of the ship came on the horn there and said, "This is the captain of the ship. Stop the firing immediately." And he actually apologized to the Marines for that, for not telling us. And he told the guys, "Just dump the rest of the ammunition over the side. We don't want that anymore." And he's the only man I ever saw in a naval officer that was a human being, because he would take responsibility for it.
You always hear about the rivalry between the Navy and the Marines and how the Marines hate the Navy, and I guess the Navy doesn't know why, but I know why now from reading your book.
Well, I was on 7 different Navy ships, and this was the only one where the people, whether it was the captain or whether it was because of the type of ship it was or whatever it was, that acted like humans and tried to treat us like humans. All of these ships, the people on them, officers and enlisted men, were going by the same old bullshit that we had put up with in boot camp, that the Navy and Army were this and the blah, 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 and that the Marines were superior. And this carried through in every place we went and everything we did. And like I say, this particular captain was the only man that was able to act like a man and apologize for that particular firing and the trouble he caused the people and his passengers.
Right.
That was very touching.
Ray, you didn't get an apology when they...
Nobody said anything. That would have been the manly thing to do.
Right. You say here on page 90, Howard, after we got back to rest camp in Hawaii, you had to be very careful of how you woke a person up day or night. Most people slept with either a pistol or a knife in their hand and would come up wild and swinging if they were startled in their sleep. We had to surrender all pistols upon arrival at rest camp to be stored till later, but most of the people from the lines slept with a knife in their hand all the time anyway, so you had to be very careful. How about you, Howard? Did you sleep with a knife in your hand too?
Sure, I slept with a knife. Everybody had a K-bar. Kept them pretty well sharpened. You used them for everything from eating your lunch to digging dead people out of the sand. Or you slept with your K-bar in your hand up against your chest, ready to use.
And with your leg cocked, ready to jump out.
Right.
Now, besides the shells falling all over the place, one of the other things that was happening all the time were the flares, right?
Oh, yeah.
What was the problem with the flares?
I have a story that is in the book, and it has to do with flares. And, of course, we would kid about the fact that the flares came down with little parachutes, and the parachutes were probably made of silk or something like that. And we would joke about the fact that we had steam-heated foxholes, because a lot of them were. You could dig down a couple feet, and it's hot. And also that we had silk toilet paper to use for when we needed to use it, because we had these little parachutes from the flares around. But that's not the flare story I want to tell.
That's a good flare story, though, because it said on page 252, these hankies were all around and found many uses.
Yeah. You could use them for whatever you needed. In the last 3 or 4 days of the battle, and this was up near the gorge, I was on a sort of a kind of semicircular, very low ridge, but it was a ridge. And in front of us was a flat area like a field, and maybe two or three times the size of a football stadium or something like that. And diagonally across was where the gorge was. And that was as close as I ever got to the gorge, and I was probably 200 yards from the gorge. But out in front of us was this large field, it was quite flat, and the demolition guys had set trip flares all over this field, which meant that if any Japanese, or us for that matter, well, we weren't going to be going out there, we knew there were trip flares out there, any Japanese soldiers were moving out there or tried to get through, they would hit one of the wires of the trip flares and a flare would go up. So then you knew that they were out there. So we were watching out there and watching out there, one of the two or three of us in that foxhole, all night long looking out there because there was an easy place for the Japanese to get around, except that maybe they knew about the trip flares too. I don't know. But we would look out there, and it wasn't too long. We could see Japanese soldiers out there. Now, these were figments of our imagination because there were Navy ships out there that were firing big flares, and sometimes a half a dozen or a dozen at a time. And I would see Japanese crawling out there, and I knew that that couldn't be because the trip flares would have gone up. And then all of a sudden, these naval flares went off, and the sky lit up like noon, and there was no one out there. And that happened many times. And I asked some of the other guys, did they see? Yeah, they saw them out there, too.
Incredible what your mind can do. Howard, what about your experience with flares?
I wouldn't say it was pleasant, because that's what the trouble was, that for every Jap that you saw moving when the flare was out there, there was probably 25 you saw that weren't there. So you couldn't go to sleep. You had to stay awake, find out whether whatever it was you saw was an actual or whether it was something that you were just seeing that your mind was making up. Your mind can make anything move out there at night.
Didn't they also illuminate everything and then you lost your vision for a while?
Also, what you tried to do, supposed to be two of you in a foxhole. One of you would watch when the flare is in the air and the other one would bend his head down and hide it under his helmet. And as soon as the flare would start to go out, you'd tap him on the shoulder and he would be up for the darkness and you'd try and lay down and cover your eyes and wait for the next flare. So that we had somebody watching all the time.